Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. Welcome to a special auspicious episode of the Nowhere Office. We're in a studio to mark the occasion. We are not working remotely. We are around the table with our guests today. It's auspicious because today is the third anniversary in the UK of lockdown, a moment which has marked the emergence of hybrid work into all our lives. And so it's fitting that we are joined by the founders of The Hybrid Future, a project I'm personally going to be associated with, but the experts in place-based analysis. Stefan, before I introduce our guests, how are you and what's it like being IRL in a studio with me?
It's very grown up. There's cloth on the table, there's soundproofing. I can get really close to the microphone for that intimate moment. And it's all good. It's all good, Julia.
And we've actually already had a water cooler moment, haven't we? Because the studios that we're in, which is in the middle of London, are used to people chatting before they record. So regard this as a mini office. In fact, there are actually, weirdly, pencils on the table in front of me and all sorts of things. So it's a pretend desk. And we're joined by Tim Oldman and Alison English. Tim is the founder and CEO of Leesman, the world's foremost authority on employee workplace experience, and Alison, his deputy CEO, who joined in 2018 as head of client services and has never left. So one of these indispensable partnerships. And I'm going to ask them to just say a little bit more about themselves before we jump in. Tim, tell us more about who you are.
Who am I? I guess I'm a frustrated designer, a frustrated strategist, a general agent provocateur and random ideas generator, and love everything to do with understanding the relationship between people and place.
Tell us about Leesman Index, because you created it, you sold it last year, which must mean that it was a success, but it's particularly germane to this moment that we're all experiencing in white-collar work.
Mm. Well, back in 2008, 2009, I was trying to prove the relationship between people and place. And Christmas 2009, I got drunk with an incredibly intelligent lawyer who said, if you think that clever tool that you've developed is so damned clever, take it out and sell the tool to the world. Stop doing the strategy work. The intelligence is in amassing enough data to actually prove the case, demonstrate through evidence that something is really happening in that relationship.
And give me the headlines on the data points. And this was all gathered pre-AI.
Mm. Yeah, it's simple stuff. Some of it isn't rocket science. It doesn't need statisticians to tell you that things like tea and coffee are important to, profiting amazing relationships between teams and organizations.
Alison, tell us more about that and in the context of you. In fact, apropos coffee, I've noticed that your cup of coffee next to me has got writing on it. What does your coffee say?
It's got a beautiful writing of the sound company in it, so I'll let it out.
Bit of branding.
A little bit of branding.
Okay, so it's not a Rorschach test.
It's not, but it's a good way to start the day.
But Alison, tell us a little bit about you and tell us a bit more about the data points that Tim's referring to. And then I'm going to ask Stefan to talk to Tim about the hybrid future.
Absolutely, I can do that. So everything Tim said at the beginning, we're yin and yang, so I'm kind of the other part of that that makes a lot of this work. So my background actually is in printing and packaging. I worked in the US in that for a number of years, spent a few years living in Asia, and then moved to the UK 6 years ago. Found Leesman 5 years ago, and it's been an amazing ride and journey ever since. So working super closely with Tim on all things to do with the business, delighted and so excited about the Hybrid Future project we're kicking off.
Before we get on to that, I've got this number in my mind of a million data points. Is that right, that you've got a million data points on behaviours in and out of offices? Or have I made that up?
You haven't made it up. It's actually, we've got more than a million respondents. So there are way more than a million data points, but there are more than a million people who have taken the Leesman Office survey since its inception, as Tim spoke about in 2010. So we've got the largest global database of employee workplace experience in the world.
Alison, it's very interesting to me that you started out in paper and packaging, which is absolutely tangible, real, material, practical. Is that helpful to you when we have these sometimes theoretical, sometimes slightly abstract conversations about the future? Do you remember your paper and production lines and think, is this real?
Absolutely. It's incredibly relevant. And I'd say the part of it that's the most relevant actually is the work that I did with a number of clients around the U.S. and then traveling around the world working with clients. I actually experienced workplace without being able to really quantify it then and the different impacts that it had on employees then. So working with different cultures and different people across those different spaces and seeing really how they use the spaces differently. Since coming to Leesman, that's really put all of it together for me.
Well, there'll always be packaging. And as John Garnett used to say, there'll always be washing up. That's one of the things about workplaces, always a kitchen, sooner or later. Tim, tell us a bit about this great piece of work on hybrid that you're launching now.
Yeah, so the last 10, 12 years for us have been an in-depth understanding, or developing an in-depth understanding of the relationship between people and corporate offices. And you can imagine 3 years ago to the day, Alison and I were sat around wondering what the heck our business was going to be doing if suddenly everybody was working from home. So the first thing was to mobilize a new study technique that would test and measure the relationship between people's own homes and the work that they were contributing. So 3 years down the track, 300,000 respondents both on home and office relationships in the pandemic period. And we're sat looking at the data wondering what happens beyond that. What is the ripple effect outside of this incredible experiment that we've all been through, that every corporate organization in the knowledge economy has been through, in this sort of new release? The old phrase, but the genie is out of the lamp when it comes to hybrid working, but the cat is also out of the bag because we've established that the general office isn't that good at supporting modern knowledge work. Now, the Hybrid Future Project says, okay, what happens next? What happens to the nighttime economy in cities if people aren't in city centres? What happens to cleaners and canteen workers in those big staff restaurants if employees are only in 3 days a week? What if? And it's basically a massive what-if scenario exploration of what if hybrid working is the way forward.
One of the things that appealed to me when you asked me, Tim, to chair the strategy board for the hybrid future is the societal context. Because I think we've all got a bit caught in the weeds, haven't we, of worrying about offices and how people go in and out and, you know, as well as the hybrid haves and have-nots, those that can't work flexibly. But your point, Tim, is very much, and we're going to be studying this, or our members are going to study it, that the whole of society is affected by these shifts from the city to the suburb and so on. Tell us a bit more about that.
I think we have to, I think, get a little bit more aware and empathetic of the sort of supply chain around us as knowledge economy employees. So whether it's Hassan, who runs the coffee shop at the station I commute into, who's seen a 40% drop in sales year on year, whether it's the train operating company trying to juggle running a break-even railway service in the UK when passenger numbers are not directly forecastable, whether it's the cleaners who maintain offices when we all go home in the evenings. There are thousands of people who feed off of us being in offices, and they have no influence over whether we return to offices or not. They're not chief executives mandating people back with anchor days or 3 days in the week or any of those other little bits of, you know, tattle that we see in the trade press. So it's about those people. I think that's what we've got to understand, what the long-term impact is on the people who feed off of us being in workplaces.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, one of the other challenges is understanding what is then the impact on all of these employees and then that sense of corporate culture. So when everyone had a bit less freedom prior to lockdown and everyone being sent home, you could count on people more or less being in the office and getting that kind of secret sauce, that dose of whatever it is that really brings people together in an organization, and having kind of that corporate workplace to draw them in. Without that, we don't know what the long-term ramifications of people being dissociated from that and almost displaced and spending more time at their homes in a lot of cases than they are around physically around their colleagues and physically around their managers and the people that they're managing. So what then happens to corporate culture? Does it start to erode? Does learning and development change? That's something we won't know the effect of until years down the road, and we'll go, oh, okay, well, this has happened, and it won't be a quick fix to change it either.
Do you think that the power imbalances or relationships have shifted, that this emerging corporate culture is based in a different standoff, if you like, between the bosses saying, where is everybody, and the workers as well, I've just shown you for 2 years, I don't have to be here all the time. Has that affected the culture?
I think in some organizations, perhaps it has. I think what we know from our data is there are a number of elements that are impacting whether or not employees are going to choose to come back into the workplace or not. And I think some of that, if the corporate culture wasn't strong, or if it wasn't a culture that people felt like they could get behind, if it was too top down, then that's not that it's them versus us. Mm. And that's become, I think, much more entrenched, because it used to be, okay, jump. Oh, how high do I jump? And that's much less. Now they're going, why do you want me to jump?
A crisis is a bad time to start trying to build better relationships.
It's true. Absolutely. Because people will feel it's disingenuous.
Mm. It's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, we're 3 years in post-pandemic and everything clearly has changed in the world of work. And the study is 3 years. Why did you choose 3 years, not 5 years?
Well, I'm going to course correct you on one thing. You said everything has changed. Actually, one thing that hasn't changed in that period is what employees do. Mm-hmm. You know, middle managers might have had to adjust slightly their sort of sense of guidance that they're offering employees that they can no longer look at in a workplace. But actually, the activities that people do, their roles within their knowledge economy businesses, have not dramatically changed.
Until ChatGPT came along a couple of months ago.
That's another podcast, right? Let's not go there. But I think it is important to recognize that the employee's role within the organization, generally speaking, has not changed anywhere near as much as the location freedom that they're now offered. So that's why we're really particularly examining that what happens when an employee goes to bed of an evening and sets their alarm for the next morning based on their choice of where they're going to be. So the three-year duration is because, as Alison said, we can't see into the future. But we need to capture enough data in terms of the trends and the trajectories and the weaving parts in order to, you know, some of the other clever people around the project, to be able to make some hypotheses that we can start talking about, to start society understanding that decisions made at a tiny individual level could have massive ramifications for other parts of our ecosystems.
Yeah. I mean, the three-year thing is that it also is clearly going to be just so different, because we did have ChatGPT come in the last 3 months, really. And I think if you're looking ahead to 2026, we just can't even grasp, can we, any of us around the table? I mean, Stefan, have you got a vision in your mind of where we could be, might be? We say that's what we do on this programme, but actually, really, we're an exploration of the famous Donald Rumsfeld phrase, the known unknowns.
Well, I think the processing power obviously grows and grows, and so the speed and power of these computers are just plough through lots of stuff. And what's got scary, of course, for white collar people is, you know, if you're an accountant, an auditor or something like that, if you're an early stage career lawyer, you know, some of this technology looks like it's going to be able to crunch through masses and masses of the old paperwork that people actually learnt their trade on. So this is a big shift. How that's going to be managed could be absolutely massive.
I mean, the role of place is central. That's what the Hybrid Future Project is anchored around, is place. Alison, where have you worked? How has your place of work changed? And do you think the place of work globally is going to continue to change as radically over the next 3 years?
Yeah, good question. So if I think back 3 years ago today, I was in a flat about 10 minutes walk from here with my 6-month-old, because the nurseries had just been closed. And I had just returned to work from maternity leave. And my husband and I were sitting at our kitchen table together, both trying to work and look after our 6-month-old. I sincerely hope that in the next 3 months or 3 years, there's nothing as dramatic as that. But for me, I'd say a victim of the COVID kind of exodus of cities, because we left London. So I'm now, you know, 30 miles instead of being 10 minutes from here, I'm 30 miles from here south.
So do you do that thing that the Wall Street Journal wrote a really interesting piece on about the long commute, the emergence of longer distances for more immersive periods of time? Is that you?
Absolutely. I build my commute into my workday. I've got an hour on the train. It's incredibly pleasant. I take my laptop out. I can do an hour's worth of work there. And I don't mind the commute because like I said, it's part of my workday and I have no problem doing it.
But to your point, Tim, about whether it's long commute or otherwise, the texture of cities and with it the infrastructure that supports the infrastructure and the supply chains that support it are changing. It doesn't feel to me that the public conversation has really grasped that, does it?
I think probably it's not happening in the sort of broadcast media and the print media in the way that it's happening in pubs and nurseries and old people's homes and the places that people are discussing this. I think we're getting a ripple, I think, that's happening. Society is cottoning on to the fact that stuff has changed. People going out, as Alison's done, bought a new house recently, but they're adding a bedroom to the requirement, or they're spotting a garage that they could convert into a home office, or they're looking at a loft and thinking, that's a great space that I could repurpose. So society has changed in the last 3 years significantly in terms of its expectation of its domestic accommodation, because people in the knowledge economy expect their employer to allow them to be able to work from home at least some proportion of their working week. So that's there, that's out there. An additional bedroom costs money. There are bigger mortgages being taken out, but on the balance of the lack of having to commute into the central corporate workplace. So people's affordability around these topics is out there and is changing. I think that's what gets us super interested in what else is happening. What is happening in, well, nurseries, if we talk about nursery care. If suddenly nurseries are being asked to provide care maybe just for 3.5 days a week, because employees are home-based for 2 days a week and they feel they don't need the nursery support.
When I was in New York recently, effectively having a long commute, I took myself off for twice as long as I normally do, 10 days, to immerse myself, to have meetings. I had a manicure. Nothing is as good as a New York manicure. By the UN, and which, for those that know New York, is around 49th and 3rd Avenue. And the Taiwanese woman giving me the manicure said, "I miss the before times," she said. "I miss the before times." And what she meant was the UN and that area was absolutely buzzing and humming. And she was really clearly saying that that's all changed because people are working remotely. And of course, the economy in those cities is changing. So, Stefan, how do you read, because you're writing so much about all of this in a wider context, how do you read this disconnect, if you like, between the way we're all individually narrowing our focus on what works for us and the economic implications and the policy implications?
Well, it's very tricky. And we see it, of course, in the labour market data and the lower participation rates and people saying, actually, this doesn't work for me. And they may be ill, they may be caring, but they may just be saying, you know, I really don't need or want that job full time anymore. And I'm going to opt out. I'm going to participate a bit less or in a different way, in a way that suits me. So for policymakers, very, very difficult. The central bank is very worried about inflation. But actually, how much economic activity can we be certain is going to be carrying forward? Maybe we've got these sort of slightly depressed, suppressed levels of activity while people try to work out over the next 3 years, how am I going to live and work?
Do you think the state could be doing more, Stefan? If we think about the commuting that I referenced earlier, you know, we have in the UK off-peak travel at a weekend and a heightened cost during the week. I mean, what if the government stepped in and said, actually, what we're going to do is subsidise travel on a Monday and Friday to help employers load balance the appeal for travelling into the office across the full traditional 5-day working week, rather than this peak occupation that we see on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? Is that the nanny state getting too involved in commerce? Or do you think that's the sort of thing that those chief execs, who are damned if they do and damned if they don't when it comes to inviting people back to the office, should be looking for, should be seeking?
I think an intelligent, active state would get stuck in like that. And given that de facto the government is taking back control of more or less all the railway network, one way or the other, and the train operating companies bit by bit, you know, we know that the railway in particular is a strategic asset and very important for London. London has gone about the railway a bit too much. Buses also very, very important. But yes, flexible ticketing can't be beyond us in 2023 with a bit of imagination. And if the private sector needs the government to give them a firm nudge, then why not?
I mean, it's not just place that dominates this. It's movement, isn't it? It's time, travel to or from a place. You know, we've made today in our little nowhere office a bit of a red letter day because it is the anniversary and we wanted to mark it. So we have come together and travelled to this studio. And that's the future of the office, isn't it, Alison? That people come into the office for a reason, not just for the culture. The culture isn't enough, is it?
I think in many cases, you're absolutely right. One of the things we published last year was a piece of research entitled Purposeful Presence, and it's been one of the most popular pieces of research that we've put out there, and it says exactly that. Employees are coming in for a specific reason. There is a purpose. It's going to be much more intentional than this is where I go to work. It's this is where I go to do these specific things that I need to do. So it's so paramount for our organizations to understand what that is and then recraft and shape the workplace around how employees want to be using it.
Which is, of course, what the original office was for, Tim. I mean, that was where the typewriter was, or that was where the IBM was, or that was where the filing cabinet was. It was also the cultural norm, but it was the place that you went to because you couldn't do the work without it. It was effectively a factory floor.
Yeah, I think for the vast majority of knowledge employees over the last 20 years, 30 years, that's been true. But I graduated in 1991 as an interior architect and designer, and the first job that I had was I was given a sketch pad and sent to site. So hybrid working in of itself isn't new. It's just suddenly we've got millions and millions of employees worldwide who are allowed to do it. You know, there were, if we go back 3 years and a couple of weeks, there are employees who worked for organizations that you and I know, they're household names, where employees weren't trusted to bring their mobile phone into the office. And a matter of weeks later, they were suddenly handed a laptop and trusted to work from home. Now, no organization that I know is going to suddenly snatch back that trust. So, you know, this is why I think the escalation of an interest in the placemaking component of why an employee should come back to the office is foremost and front of center of most of the organizations that we're around at the moment.
Let's do a thought experiment as we sort of wind our way to the end of this little audio journey. Where is the place you worked that you most vividly remember and why, Stefan?
Well, I'm probably...
It's an age-related question, obviously. We are not surrounded by Gen Zs around this table. Sorry for the complete lack of diversity in that regard. We're all quite old, Alison's although Alison's younger. Quite young. Alison, you're a millennial. Class as an aging millennial?
I probably do now.
After two kids.
Thank you very much.
All right. Anyway, so the point being is we've got some experience under our belt. Yeah. Stefan, start with you. Where's the place that you can smell and touch and hear and why?
Well, I've had so many different jobs. I'm probably going to have to say when I worked at the FT on One Southwark Bridge, their old offices, and had the great privilege to sit next to Lucy Kellaway, the great columnist, who did exactly what you're talking about, Tim. She used the office, I'm not betraying anything here, to kind of connect with people, get up to speed with the gossip, make a few notes. She then emailed, when you could email, notes back home. And she wrote the column at home. She didn't do the work, capital W, in the office in that sense, but the office was incredibly useful to her to kind of get the smell of the place and what was in the air and what she needed to be writing about. So I learned a hell of a lot by... I was her office husband, as she called me. I think I was her fifth office husband, and that was my career highlight.
And how many offices have you worked in, roughly? I feel that's a sort of slightly intimate question. There are other sort of questions. People say, how many have you?
Mostly magazines, mostly journal. Yeah, not quite 10, but I've probably done 7 or 8, I think, when I think about it.
Tim?
I'm probably at the same number if you think of, you know, employers that I've worked for who had me going to a specific location that you would consider their office. But actually, Stefan reminded me of the other thing that through my career I've experienced is hundreds and hundreds of other offices, because when you're working for customers, you get the opportunity to go and sit in their place. And one of the absolute highlights for me was I was working with Channel 4 News, part of ITN, and Jon Snow invited me, the anchor for the programme, invited me to sit in one of the daily editorial meetings. So at 10:30 in the morning, about 70 people crammed into a space not much bigger than this podcast booth, the recording booth we're in. There were people under the table, on the filing cabinets, you name it.
No social distancing.
No social distancing whatsoever. But the energy in the room as John gathered his editorial team to debate what was going to be broadcast that day was visceral. And I think that's the thing that gets me addicted to the place as an important, you know, component of work.
Alison?
For me, I've worked in a number of offices as well. And as Tim said, my journey has been spending a lot of time in client offices. And the one that really stands out the most to me was a meeting I had in Durban in South Africa at Unilever's office there, sitting outside on a picnic table, overlooking the ocean in incredible weather, having a discussion with the kind of senior client that I had there. And why that stands out to me is because the offices that I had worked in before were traditional, the American ones are very traditional American offices, cubicles, meeting rooms, but they didn't have kind of some of the informal spaces and some of those areas you could just go and kind of have a nice chat. It was either all or nothing. And again, seeing Unilever was a client of mine for a number of years, and I went to a number of their spaces around the world, and kind of seeing how they redesigned and how they used space and how you could then it didn't have to be as stuffy and curated. It could be much more informal and relaxed. And it just changed the mood. It changes how you approach the conversation. It changes the way you work. And I had never experienced that until then. And it fundamentally changed, again, how I wanted to spend time in spaces and appreciate that. So, yeah.
Well, I have two because I'm greedy. One of them is working at the BBC as a researcher, as a baby researcher, when Television Centre had not been sold, I think, to Soho House. And that was very interesting because there's a very different dynamic if you work for an enormous corporation. And I just vividly remember that journey, and they had a famous horseshoe formation, and I remember the sort of scale of the in-house cafes at that time. It all felt sort of fantastically grand.
Three different restaurants at least.
Yeah, they had a lot of stuff. But the place I remember most was Virago Press in the 1980s in William the Fourth Street in London, in what is memorably called in UK parlance a higgledy-biggledy office. We've just heard that phrase. I mean, it was a little rabbit warren of old. It's before it was repurposed, and it right on the edge of Trafalgar Square, and it was a group of women in a very, very, very tiny company, making history, actually, with what they were publishing. And I remember the rabbit warren of offices and the role that curiosity and popping your head around the corner, which is really so much of what we're trying to recreate. So I suppose the reason for asking us all is, I think we're all wistful, aren't we, and nostalgic for something that was lost, whilst recognising that we're in new territory, or am I getting that wrong? I'm a bit wistful for an age that's gone, even though I'm absolutely an advocate for the fact that we're nowhere near where we were. Tim?
I was intrigued when you asked the question, actually, because I thought Alison was going to give you another workplace that she's talked to me often about, which was where her first experience of workplaces, which was the complete opposite of what you've just described. And so I think we do easily forget that whilst we all tabled those amazing spaces or those beautiful experiences we had of the relationship between people in a specific place, there are millions of employees around the world who work in the most awful environments that obstruct every component of their working day. And I think that sort of friction-based office is why so many employees, when somebody said to them, is there any chance you could work at home because there's this global pandemic, they ran there with such pace that they do not want to come back.
You raise a good point, actually. In that very glamorous time working at the BBC, I actually worked in a corrugated iron tin add-on extension, which got fantastically hot and uncomfortable in the summer. We're drawing to a close. Alison, what is your crystal ball telling us? What are we going to be talking about in relation to work in the near future? What do you think is coming up that you expect us to be talking more about?
I genuinely think we're going to be talking about a lot of the same things we're talking about now. I think, you know, what happened 3 years ago today was kind of one of these unprecedented events. I think going forward, what's happening, if something terrible goes wrong, it's a bit of a steamroller. We're not going to know it until later, so we're going to keep doing this. But then at some point might go, oh, actually, 3 years ago, we should have done something differently. But I don't see anything dramatic, barring another pandemic happening.
And before we finish, Tim, I sincerely hope that when you go to Bali on Friday, which you've told me you're doing, that is not going to be a nowhere office. Tell me that's going to be an actual holiday.
I will be reading a pile of books, all of which have some impact on our future in terms of the relationship between people and place. Because I think the one thing that I've lost working from home is that peace and quiet. Yeah, that actually, you know, the 12-hour flight there is a beautifully idyllic space in which to focus and concentrate. My home used to be a place where I could focus and concentrate. I work from home now, and Alison's zooming me every 5 minutes. And if another colleague doesn't manage to get in the gaps in between, I'm looking for some isolation for that focused and deep work. That's what I'm going to be doing.
And will they be books on paper or on a Kindle?
They are definitely going to be on paper, Stefan.
Well, that's terrific. And we look forward to hearing more from you all about this hybrid future, the hybrid project from Leeselman. And thank you very much to Tim Ullman and Alison English for joining us here in the Nowhere office today.
Thanks, Stefan.
Thanks for having us.
Stefan, that's it for Series 4. It's been pretty eclectic. We've listened to trade unionists, we've listened to writers, we've been to New York, we have been to Davos, we have been to Vienna. I think we need a little bit of a lie down now.
I think that's right. A nowhere office out of the office or out of nowhere or something, but a break. Yes, it's been fantastic working with you on this series, Julia, and I look forward to more to come.
And we'll see you in the summer. Thank you for being with us. This Nowhere Office production, recorded on the third anniversary of the pandemic in London, was recorded at the Sound Company Studios with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
It's a fully connected production, and music is by Julian Brejean. Thank you for being with us. Follow us at the Nowhere Office on Twitter.